agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by the professor of law at Chase Law School, Ken Katkin. Ken, welcome to week two of you and me on The Politics Guys.
Two out of three. We're going to do a three-peat next week.
I know. It's exciting. Now, just for our listeners, I know that Mike on Facebook said, look, you know, Jay is missing and there's been a coup, right? He was accusing Ken and I of a coup. And I want you to say that, listen, Jay is not missing. He's just locked in my basement and he can't come out right now. Now, if that's a coup, I don't know. Anyway, but no, it is a lot of fun to get to be doing our 3 weeks together, Ken. You know, this week we're going to be tackling some things about NATO. We're going to be tackling the ongoing new Supreme Court investigations coming out of the AP. We're going to be talking about inflation and what's happening there. And then we're also going to be talking a little bit about the evolution of Representative Green. And we might have some more from there. We'll see if we have time to do. But I think what we're going to kick off with here is NATO, because this week NATO member nations held their summit in Lithuania. And it isn't hard to imagine it was full of intrigue, like, you know, any bit of international relations, like all of the books the Kins have ever recommended. Right now, the biggest of these, of course, is what is NATO's relationship to Ukraine and what ought that relationship look like? Now, I thought Vox laid it out pretty well this week when they said that, quote, Western leaders are worrying whether Ukraine and their own stockpiles can sustain such a war, end quote. And it's worth pointing out at the same time that NATO's thinking about how they're going to continue to support Ukraine, that Biden also decided to reverse an earlier decision and send cluster bombs to Ukraine. And I think that kind of colored a little bit of what was going on there. Now, that was a decision that has caused a lot of discourse. And in this case, I think probably one of the biggest cases of where the left was probably a little bit more hesitant than the right, although there was some bipartisan hesitancy, and we can talk a little bit more about that. Just from a point of view, 120 countries have banned the use of cluster bombs for a variety of reasons: their ability to hit civilians, their ability to hang around if they don't explode for decades and still be deadly. Although it is worth noting that the United States, Ukraine, and Russia are not actually signatories to any of those treaties. If anybody's interested in kind of that take, you can take a look at CNN kind of have the right wing, ironically, position for why we need to send cluster bombs. But be that as it may, you know, this, I think, sets up some of the stage for what we saw happening in NATO. So to return to Lithuania, NATO appeared to largely want to show unity against Russia. Now, what Ukraine wanted was a substantial timeline for joining the alliance instead of this, quote unquote, one day. Now, the United States was clear it was not interested in a faster timeline because it does not want to be directly involved in the conflict. Now, the final report from NATO that we got this week was Ukraine can join when, quote, conditions are met, end quote. But the document itself does not spell out or list what those conditions are. Now, I would say as a political scientist, I think, you know, this is kind of clearly unclear language. You can join, maybe, if you win the war against Russia and a sufficient time after winning there remains peace. I mean, that clearly is what NATO is talking about here, although they don't want to put it quite in those terms. Now, Ukrainian President Zelensky, he was not happy about this, and this is one of the bigger rifts we've seen come out. As numerous outlets have put it, his tone was, quote, sharp. And he called it, quote, unprecedented and absurd, end quote, that no time frame was set for NATO membership. So again, the takeaway is clear. Countries want to support Ukraine as a proxy, but not drawn to the point where NATO countries would be involved on the ground. Now, Biden would point out that despite their differences, The unity of NATO proved Putin wrong, even on the point of Ukraine. As he said, quote, "We are ready. We were ready because we stood together," end quote. Now, in addition to that, of course, Ken, we have the other country trying to get into NATO, and that's Sweden. But Turkey initially threw up a number of roadblocks, holding a veto over the entry of Sweden into NATO, arguing that they would only back it if the EU members would agree to revive Turkey's negotiations to join the EU. Now, that position softened by the end of the conference when the President Erdogan agreed to withdraw his objection Monday, but still seems to be kind of taking that on a slow boat. So we'll see. He says he's going to take that up for ratification in, with Turkey's legislature in October. President Biden was credited with making that shift with Turkey possible. So for me, Ken, I see the two big items here is we have the relationship of Ukraine to NATO, what that means for the war, what that means in terms of munitions headed to Ukraine. And then, of course, you know, we have Sweden, which is making this bid because of the moves by Russia and maybe these slow boatings by Turkey. Do you agree with that? And what do you see happening on those two fronts?
So on the front with Turkey and on the front with Ukraine, you're saying?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, OK, let's talk about Turkey first, because we'll probably talk about Ukraine longer. So, yeah, Turkey, you know, it sits pretty uneasily within NATO and right kind of on the periphery of the EU, because, you know, in case listeners don't know, Turkey has been applying since the 1980s to be in the EU. And while the EU has never granted full membership to Turkey, along the path to that, it has entered into a lot of agreements with Turkey that do give, you know, many of the rights that EU members would have. So there is, for instance, free movement of people between Turkey and the EU, you know, which, for instance, there no longer is with the United Kingdom.
Right.
So, yeah. So so it has it definitely has some of the kinds of rights. And there's a few other countries in Europe also that are not full-fledged members of the EU, but that are in agreements with the EU that give some of those rights. So Turkey has been wanting to move that forward. And I guess its rhetorical position has been, you know, if Europe is slowballing full Turkish membership in the EU, then Turkey's going to slowball, you know, anyone else's membership in any organization that Turkey's a member of, including Swedish membership in NATO. Now, in NATO itself, you know, Turkey sometimes, you know, is on the verge of being kicked out of NATO because they have never stopped doing many deals with Putin. They have much friendlier relations with Russia than other NATO countries do. They've consistently violated all the current sanctions that the West has imposed on Russia and because of the Ukraine war. And that's actually made it possible for Russia to do a lot of international commerce that the sanctions would otherwise prohibit it from doing. So, so you know, Turkey's not a member in great standing in NATO. It's not a member. It's not a country that the EU has been anxious to accept for membership. And I don't really know where that's all headed. I think, you know, I wouldn't love to let Turkey join any treaty organization that I was a member of, especially under their current government. But on the other hand, there's, you know, there's strategic reasons to include them in things. I mean, in NATO, it's probably better to have them as a unreliable ally than as just, you know, an adversary.
Yeah.
And in the EU, you know, the more economic integration and movement of people there is in Europe, you know, I guess the hope is that that's going to be a salutary and beneficial influence on Turkey and help moderate Turkey. So I guess those are the arguments for including
well,
and, it more,
and but, just to kind yeah. of put some of that more in perspective there, Ken, because, you know, you talk about, you know, Turkey. I mean, one of the things, it sits kind of in that transitional position when you think of it as a political scientist, right? It's not a fully formed democracy. You know, Freedom House, for example, consistently ranks them as not free. You know, they had authoritarian rule through the 1950s. You know, so their civil and their political rights continue to rank low. So they are that kind of difficult oddball out when it comes to You know, those are not the kinds of scores you're seeing in your typical EU country, right?
Yeah, it's not a modern Western democracy, no. And it has much more in common with Putin's Russia than with most of the its NATO allies. And that's very problematic. But I guess there's the old adage, you know, maybe you want to, you know, keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer, right? And, you know, Turkey, you know, maybe it's better for the West to keep Turkey in the Western fold, even though it doesn't really operate like a Western country.
Well, and of course, there is, and again, this is not a perfect correlation, but one that is a possibility theory is to suggest that as you have more economic and political ties, you tend to see authoritarian and non-free countries or transitional countries move more towards democratic and freedom often. Now, again, that's not a perfect correlation. That's something that, you know, scholars still explore, but there is evidence to suggest that that is one way, right? So if you isolate a country, they're more likely to kind of reinforce authoritarian impulses, whereas if you can take those transitional countries and have certain kinds of connections with them, you do increase possibly the likelihood of them moving more free.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why the EU has moved in the direction of integrating Turkey, even though they've never granted Turkey full membership. It's precisely for that hope. And I think that hope is generally true. I think it generally bears out, but not always. You know, there's counterexamples, and I think Hungary's been another counterexample. And one could say that Russia itself is a counterexample because, you know, the West moved a lot closer to it during the Yeltsin years. And then, you know, that didn't keep it moving in a good direction. We got the Putin years after that.
Yeah. Well, I would say, and this is kind of off topic, then when you get back to Ukraine, I actually have kind of a unique theory on Russia. It's not, excuse me. I subscribe to a theory that I don't think gets enough airtime on Russia. I don't want to make it sound like I'm the one who came up with this unilaterally. You know, I have things I've come up with. This is not one of them. But I think part of the problem with Russia was not that connection, but so much as it was almost what you might call the original sin of its transition from authoritarian communist rule. Because effectively what you have happen is not real divestment of assets by the government, but instead you have the same individuals who happen to be, you know, Communist Party members, then controlling those in the so-called free market. So there's a whole suggestion that that really was more of a unique case. But you're right. I mean, theoretically, if it's going to work, it should work there. But let's get back over there to this issue of Ukraine and its membership in NATO, because I think you're right. We're going to need to spend more time talking about that.
Yeah, it's you know, I think you've summarized everything really well. You know, there's a lot of reasons to want Ukraine to be in NATO, and there's also a lot of reasons that you don't want a country joining NATO that's already fighting a hot war.
Right.
Because that commits every member country to being combatants in that hot war. And, you know, that basically commits the U.S. to having a declared war against Russia for the first time in history. Right. We had the Cold War for a long time and we had a lot of proxy wars. But there were reasons that they didn't want the Cold War to turn into a hot war. I mean,
there are books written about this.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, literally the fate of the Earth would be at stake there. You know, you're talking about countries that have the capability of ending life on Earth if they get in a hot war with each other. So I think both your summary was good, and I think the underlying policy is good. I mean, I think what the NATO is signaling, you know, they did a couple things that are, I think, very positive for Ukraine, you know, just sort of both rhetorically and functionally. Rhetorically, it's the first time ever that there's a unanimous vote of all NATO members saying that Ukraine does belong in NATO, and it's just a question of when time and circumstances allow. But in principle, they should be a NATO member, and they will be a NATO member. You know, that is something that there's never been unanimity about before until this week. And the other thing is that as a functional or practical matter, there is a process for joining NATO, and it involves something called a membership action program or MAP, where a list of benchmarks and timelines are laid out, and the applicant country has to comply with these benchmarks and timelines before they can get membership. And, you know, on the one hand, you know, as you noted, Zelensky's complaining, well, they wouldn't even give us a membership action program, which is true. But the other half of that is they actually waived the requirement. Right. So in this thing, you know, NATO says, well, we want Ukraine as a member when time and circumstances allow. And in fact, when time and circumstances allow, we're just going to make them a member. They're not going to have to go through a membership action program like every other non-original member has had to go through. So I think it's a pretty strong statement that Ukraine is part of the West. That the West isn't going to, you know, be drawn into a hot war that could become a nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia right now, but that we're going to keep the whole West, the unified West, is going to keep supplying quite a lot of military aid as we have been this whole time, and that we expect that Ukraine is going to see its way through this conflict. Yeah, so NATO is expanding now. Finland joined, Sweden just joined, Ukraine will be joining, and these are all countries that are actually physically on the border with Russia, as is Turkey. And so, you know, that's really speaking to a world where something like a future invasion of Ukraine, you know, isn't going to be possible, because Russia is not going to attack any NATO member country. And there's starting to be a ring around Russia of NATO member countries.
Yeah, you know, this is something that I have pondered. I think it's unlikely. I mean, you say they're not going to invade a NATO country. And I would say I 85% agree with you. But I can't help but wonder, especially as we see some of the internal, you know, we covered last week some of the internal politics happening in Russia. I can imagine a cornered Putin doing some pretty dangerous things. And so I can't help but have like 10 or 15% of myself that thinks, I could see the man blowing things up. But I'm curious, I mean, do you have that? Are you kind of that 80, 90, 10, 15% like I am? Or are you more confident that, look, Putin's not going to do that?
Yeah, I'm even more confident. And the reason for that is, let's suppose I agree with your number of 80%. There's 80% chance that Putin would be dissuaded or disincentivized to invade, but there's still a 20% chance that he wouldn't care and he would do it. Well, I think even if I accept that number as an accurate number, I don't think he could pull it off, because, you know, he's got his own people think of him as a dictator. But he's got to keep the military on his side. He's got his own version of the Pentagon to deal with. And I think there's cooler heads over there. And they're not going to launch a suicide mission like that. There's some kind of process. You know, I mean, he obviously controls his parliament a lot more than our U.S. presidents control our Congress. But there's even a certain point.
The understatement of the world says every Biden official right now. But continue.
But I'm saying, even with the extent that, you know, he largely can choose who's in the parliament and that, you know, he largely tells them how to vote. You know, I think there's limits to that. And, you know, starting with what's going to be a nuclear war against NATO, that's going to be a suicide mission for sure. You know, I think he's not going to be able to get it done, even if he decides that's what he wants to do.
Yeah. Now, I think something else here, and this might come off as unusual, but I think it's important. I think that precisely what we saw happen in Lithuania and what we've seen happen with this is an example of, while I have deep policy disagreements in some areas with Biden, the Biden administration, why Biden was an excellent presidential pick for the time that we were had vis-a-vis the alternative in Trump. I mean, I just can't imagine, you know, getting Turkey to turn around, walking this line with both supporting the Ukraine, but being willing to, you know, kind of draw important lines with Ukraine. Those are not easy tasks. And I think this is an area, it's not going to help win any points politically in terms of an election, but I do think it's an area where Biden and the Biden administration should get some credit.
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought you were going to, agree more vociferously than that.
I agreed. I didn't.
Yeah. Okay, like, yes, there you go, Trey.
Trey, you're so right. You're so right. I agree so much. You're so right.
That's all good. That's all good. Is there anything else that we think anything I've missed here from my overview that I think we need to talk about in terms of NATO, Ken?
You know, I do think the situation of Turkey is interesting. We talked about it a little bit already, but you know, no country's ever been kicked out of NATO, and I don't think Turkey, you know, will be kicked out of NATO. But I think it is a real conundrum for the other NATO countries to think about kind of how to keep Turkey in line, when I think, you know, consistently Erdogan's sympathies are much more with Putin than with his NATO allies, and he's in constant communication with Putin, and he does sometimes try to undermine NATO in quiet ways, and it's not a great situation. Maybe besides that, the only other issue we didn't talk about at all, there was an op-ed in the New York Times today by a scholar at the Columbia University Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies, where he was arguing that Europe doesn't even need the U.S. as much as it used to, and that Europe is fully capable with a military alliance, with or without the United States, of presenting a unified defensive front strong enough to contain Russia, and that factor will end up ultimately weakening the United States and making it less relevant in world geopolitics. And I was trying to think about that. I don't know what to think about it, but I found that a kind of provocative thing that I read this week, you know, in response to everything that was just happening at the summit in Lithuania. And I don't know if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, I mean, I suppose that it's definitely true. One of the things that we have, I think, rightfully pushed for is that European countries need to spend their proportion of what it's going to take for defensive measures. And, you know, that is one area where, although I disagreed with the means of undertaking it, I agreed with the Trump administration in terms of, look, you know, Europe needs to spend proportionally what we have to spend to make defense occur. But I mean, I guess the flip side of that, of course, is true, is if you make that the case, you won't get to make the same kinds of soft demands, right? I mean, so, you know, if you are picking up a significant portion of the budget, of course, that means that other individuals might be willing to kind of cede to your decisions in terms of the United States. But I don't know if that's, I mean, it seems like the undertone, I haven't read the article, Ken, but yeah, it seems like the undertones of that, that's a bad thing. And I'm not sure that I would suggest that that's a bad thing. I think that, I'm not sure if hegemony, I'm not sure.
No, actually, yeah. I think you're right. I agree with you on that too. But I don't actually, I may have mischaracterized. I don't think the author of the piece meant to say whether it was a good or bad thing. I think he just meant to say it's a real thing. Like he was saying, and he was saying that the for instance, he has some numbers in here. Like he says the GDP of the EU last year was 16 trillion. The GDP of Russia was 2 trillion. And so he's saying, like, you know, the EU just obviously has incredibly more resources to bring to bear than Russia does. And so, you know, those extra resources that they get from the U.S., you know, they, with or without them, that, you know, they would be fine. And he was also talking about Russia kind of proving itself in the Ukraine war to be more of a paper tiger than people realized. And so that if the European countries thought, well, you know, Russia has enormous military resources and we could never handle them without U.S. assistance, you know, Russia's kind of, you know, showed the whole world that that's not true, although of course there has been U.S. assistance. So, so I think he was just sort of saying that's the future, and you know that maybe it is. I mean, the U.S. has certainly taken an isolationist turn. The EU is it is a larger economic bloc than the U.S. is now, or even than all of North America is now, and so you know maybe that's just the way things are going, and I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Now the one caveat, again, I'd have to look more closely, is, and you hinted at it there as well, is, I mean, of course, we are sending a significant amount of munitions and funding to Ukraine, you know, minus the United States doing that. It's always hard. One of the things, you know, I think a lot of times it makes for phenomenal writing, but it can be very difficult science, is to try to suggest, well, if we tweaked these variables, you know, in the past, what would have been the outcome in the present? But yeah, I think that would be one area where, you know, the United States was obviously the lead on that front and was the coordinator for making that happen to the Ukraine. Again, I don't know what would have happened without the United States taking that position. But I can certainly imagine scenarios in which there was not as much munitions, types of munitions, or funding for Ukraine, minus the United States taking a leadership role on that front, to play maybe a kind of a devil's advocate a little bit there.
Yeah, I agree with that. And actually, I think that's also true about the soft power aspects of the United States, that particularly countries like Germany, which really, you know, were buying most of their energy resources from Russia and really had to sacrifice a lot more to impose sanctions against Russia. I think it was, you know, that might not have happened if the U.S. hadn't kind of put all that pressure on them. And that depends, you know, on the U.S.'s ability to put pressure on other countries.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. Well, Ken, any last thoughts there on that?
No, I'm glad we got to talk about an international story to start the show.
Well, and we lead it off, right? There you go. We're always doing the international thing. So I think what we're going to need to do, if I'm seeing this right, is let's move forward to the AP's investigation of the Supreme Court. And we're going to kind of handle two parts of this because we kind of have two major Supreme Court stories coming out. So we'll start with the APs, which apparently, if you take a look at what they've been filing, is predates what ProPublica was doing. They've been working on in-depth investigation concerning the Supreme Court using hundreds of public information requests around the country, especially as it relates to libraries, other public universities, and things of that nature. And what they were doing, what they were trying to get a handle on, was to take a look at Supreme Court justices who are making money in other ways and how they use their staff to make those efforts happen. That kind of was the focus primarily. And what the AP found, what was kind of making waves this past week, was that Sotomayor's staff had urged colleges, libraries, and others who were hosting book events to buy significant quantities of her books. Now, this is something we talked about, you know, first, the two of us had, Ken, we talked about Justice Thomas, and again with Jay and myself when we took on Alito, is to remember that there are no particular ethics rules. So while there are ethic rules that bar members of Congress and the executive branch from, quote, using government resources, including staff for personal financial gain, end quote, those rules don't necessarily apply to the Supreme Court. Be that as it may, what the AP found is that Sotomayor has made some $3.7 million, by far the most of any Supreme Court member, since she joined the court in 2009, and that her taxpayer-funded court staff is what made many of her ventures possible, far exceeding what they saw from other members of the high court. Now, some of the more troubling interactions, according to the AP, were those where there seemed to be some difficulties over the requiring of book purchases to meet with Sotomayor, because theoretically, you're not supposed to have a book requirement to have these public officials. Now, what's interesting is in terms of the Supreme Court members have an annual salary of $285,400 a year. They can go over that by $30,000 for other things, but the one exception is, in fact, book sales. Book sales are not included in that. As the AP has put it, though, when it comes to what they have seen, quote, none of the justices has forcefully leveraged public sponsored travel to boost book sales, as has Sotomayor, according to her emails and other records received, end quote. This has also led to some discussions, and this is something that Jay and I took on with Alito, to issues of recusal when it comes to Penguin, where the court had noted that she had not, due to an inadvertent admission, end quote, but of course, similarly, nothing that she did or wouldn't have done affected anything because that court, those cases were not opted to be taken up. So here's where we're at with Sotomayor. I mean, it clearly hasn't necessarily violated any rules. The AP sees this as kind of being shady and paints the story in that way. Both Democrats and Republicans have kind of come out against this. And it seems to me, I'm curious about you, Ken, you know, for me personally, I gave Justice Thomas a lot of, I thought, well, I had a lot of leeway for him. And clearly, you know, what we had talked about, he had violated those rules, I think it's pretty straightforwardly. Then again, with Alito, I didn't see that. And then here with Sotomayor, I see kind of a sleaze move that's not necessarily illegal. But what I think this might do, since we now see it crossing ideological divides, this might give there being enough bipartisan support to rethink having some ethics rules that do, in fact, apply to the Supreme Court in a more meaningful way. What do you think about that, Ken?
No, my prediction will be 180 degrees the opposite. This kind of scurrilous reporting on Justice Sotomayor, who did not do anything wrong, is going to make a complete bipartisan consensus within the Supreme Court that they shouldn't have any ethics rules on the Supreme Court, that the very reason that they never wanted to have ethics rules apply to themselves is because they thought that that would be a basis for unfair partisan attacks against them. And now they will all think that. So they will never impose any ethics rules on themselves. And Congress won't do it either because Congress is too dysfunctional. But, you know, Justice Sotomayor, the things that people are complaining about here, you know, for one thing, they don't violate any rules because for the Supreme Court doesn't have ethical rules that apply to it. The ethical rules that apply to other federal judges and not even to the Supreme Court, as you explained, actually permit them to earn relatively unlimited royalties on books so long as they sell the actual books. And the disclosure rules, which sometimes do apply under the Ethics in Government Act, and which Justice Thomas, you know, consistently violated for decades, Justice Sotomayor reported all of this royalty income. It's all public disclosure. So she disclosed it all. Nothing's been concealed. Every one of her public appearances was public. Everybody knows where she went to do book talks. Everybody knows how many books she sold. Everybody knows how much she was paid. So even in principle, she didn't do anything. Not only didn't she violate any rules, there shouldn't be any rule against anything she did.
Well, for lower courts, her use of staff for what she was doing would be an ethical violation.
Okay, but that that's such a minor thing. I mean, it shouldn't be an ethical violation. I mean, it's because the purpose of these ethical rules and the problem with what Justice Thomas and Justice Alito do is that they're essentially allowing themselves to be corrupted by partisans who are trying to ingratiate themselves with them to affect their ideology and to affect their decision making. And they're showering them with huge gifts. And these guys know that that's crooked and they're trying to keep it all secret. Now, in Justice Sotomayor's case, you know, the money from selling the books is coming from millions of people who buy the books. It's not, there's nobody who's ingratiating themselves with her.
Well, in this particular case, who's buying the books, that, I mean, again, I'm not necessarily, I think it underwrites your opinion, but it's in fact the locations, the libraries and the universities that she is convincing to purchase the books and purchase them in large amounts of the books, especially when it comes in terms to the children's books, which make money and give in particular in people access. I mean, I don't necessarily think that destroys your argument, but I do think that's different than saying, well, oh, just a lot of people bought the book and then showed up to these things. You're talking about staff who are trying to get different locations to purchase super large quantities of these books.
So I think you need to divide or distinguish two different issues that you're raising and keep them separate from each other. So I think one issue that you're trying to raise about the staff is that the government pays the salaries of the staff and the government expects the staff to be working on government business. And she's having the staff work on her own private side hustle and not on government business. And so that's a little bit of a fraud or a deception on the taxpayers who are paying the salaries of her staff. So I think that's the argument there about the use of the staff.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I both will grant the legitimacy of that argument, but say it's incredibly minor to the point where the cure would be worse than the disease because, you know, her staff is, and every judge's staff, every federal judge, including the Supreme Court, their staff is incredibly small, right? So she probably has like, you know, maybe four law clerks, maybe two secretaries, and, you know, they have to do the work of running the chambers. And, you know, any amount of time that they put into this, it's really, really chump change. You know, if you compare this to, you know, the other branches of government, you know, where, you know, we don't want to see, you know, the president or the Congress, you know, having their staffers working on their side hustles. Well, you know, they could be that kind of diversion of public resources could be gobbling up, you know, a lot of resources because there's a lot of staff. You know, here we're, you know, again, the total staff of a Supreme Court justice's office is about six people. And all of those people actually have to do all the work of running the justice's office. So we could only be talking about, you know, such an incredibly tiny waste of public resources here, if there is a waste of public resources, that I do think that the cure is worse than the disease. The idea that this can be seen as an ethics scandal just based on that is a worse problem than the very minor use of very minor amounts of taxpayer money. Now, if the other thing that you were talking about is that, I actually went to one of these talks, so I'll use a real world example. Justice Sotomayor came around to my kid's high school, Walnut Hills High School in Cincinnati. She did do a book talk there. There was a, you know, the high school doesn't sell books, but they were told to bring a bookseller there. And there's a local bookstore in Cincinnati called Joseph Beth. And they came over and sold books and, you know, probably sold hundreds of books that night. And people lined up to have Justice Sotomayor autograph them. Now, I think what you'd have to be positing to say that there was anything corrupt about that. And again, this was all public. It was all publicly disclosed. The speech was at Walnut Hills High School. The bookseller was Joseph Beth. That was in all the newspapers. Everybody knew it. All the book sales are disclosed in her disclosure forms. Now, you'd have to posit that after all that disclosure has been publicly made, that there's a case in the Supreme Court that either Walnut Hills High School or Joseph Beth Books are involved in it. That somebody looks at the public disclosure forms and says to Justice Sotomayor, well, you sold books through Joseph Beth at Walnut Hills High School and made money off this, so I want you to recuse, and that she would refuse to recuse herself. That all that would have to happen before there's even a possibility that anybody could say that anything like this was corrupt. And as you noted, certainly nothing like that ever happened. And the closest that ever happened is that there were people who applied for cert in Supreme Court cases where cert was never granted. And so nobody even drew it to Justice Sotomayor's attention. So she probably voted not to grant cert in those cases. The large majority had to. But if one of those cases would have actually got docketed, then, you know, at that point, people start looking at who the litigants are, and there could have been recusal motions, and nothing ever got that far. So there's no actual corruption. There's nobody from Walnut Hills High School who's calling up Justice Sotomayor and saying, hey, you know, I hosted you at the high school. You know, now I want to ingratiate myself with you and meet with you and spread my ideology to you. It's not the same as the Harlan Crow type thing, and I think it's not comparable.
Well, let's take a brief pause and then come back. And we actually need to kind of get back to that because we need to talk a little bit more about what happened with Justice Clarence Thomas this past week as well. So, Ken, I mean, we had the AP investigation, but then we also have coming out of this additional revelations from Justice Thomas. Now, again, the two of us, we'd already taken this up in terms of his relationship with Crow and clearly some problematic relationships. And on that front, I think we agreed. This week, what ended up coming out was that Thomas's clerk had received money through Venmo. Now, okay, for anybody who doesn't know, like Ken, what Venmo, I'm just teasing Ken.
I barely know what Venmo is.
Venmo is a way to electronically send money to each other. Now, what makes Venmo unique and weird, and I'll never forget the first time I actually I grabbed it because students there were talking about it, and I'm always trying to keep up with these things, is imagine if you actually included like 128 characters to explain what you were paying, and then that was public. So in other words, anybody on Venmo can just look through and be like, oh, look, you know, some Trey Orndorff sent $40 to Ken, you know, and then I can write whatever I want to go along with that. And so, as a matter of fact, the only Venmo that I've ever done was I did one once to a buddy of mine, and I put down for inappropriate reasons, right? Like I wrote something, I won't say exactly what I put, just because I knew it'd be public, I thought it'd be funny. I should probably rethink that. Because I thought it was dumb, right? The whole idea of, okay, who, you know, I can't understand any circumstance and when I want to give money to somebody and then I'm gonna make it public. But anyway, that is what Venmo is, which makes it different from things like Apple Pay, Google Pay, or probably the most popular of these, which is PayPal. Okay, bring it back to Justice Thomas. What ended up happening was a number of former clerks sent an undisclosed amount of money to the current clerk, which all has, again, in those little tags, you can write what you want to, different things which relate to a Christmas party or to Thomas's Christmas party, or abbreviations that seem to indicate Thomas and his Christmas party. Now, of course, we don't know the details or the amounts. And as soon as the AP made contact with the clerk, the Venmo was made private, which is a step that you can take, although that is a multi-step process. A lot of scholars on this, Ken, basically said, look, it could be both perfectly innocent or a terribly corrupt. It's really tough to tell. But in the wake of what had happened before, it's hard to not read it, I'll say myself, in a good light, one way or the other. And again, it just kind of added to, I think, a large number of stories this week on Supreme Court members. What do you say about that? Or at least, especially that view from other ethicists for the court?
Yeah, I mean, I think there could be innocent explanations for these payments, but I do think it's incumbent upon Justice Thomas to say what those are, you know, especially because, you know, some of the payments came from lawyers with business before the court, and in 100% of those cases, he voted their way, right? So one of them was Patrick Strawbridge, who was the lawyer who just recently won the affirmative action case. One of them was Kate Todd, who served as White House deputy counsel under Donald Trump. She worked for Pat Cipollone in the White House counsel's office, which, you know, won some cases or at least argued some cases and got Thomas's vote. In fact, they got Thomas's vote even on the case about trying to investigate the election, where he was the only one who voted that way. So I think he should, you know, explain why his law clerk was taking Venmo payments from his former clerks who are currently lawyers with business before the court. There was some other reporting on other Thomas undisclosed stuff that came out this week, too. There was a big New York Times piece about a group called the Horatio Alger Society, which Thomas is a member of. And they've constantly been also taking him on vacations and also allowing him to choose recipients for scholarships that they grant out, and doing things like that. He never disclosed any of that. The Times article also talked about how he never disclosed that somebody had paid for a vacation that he took in the Bahamas in the mid 80s. Now, he wasn't a federal judge yet then, but he was the chairman of the EEOC. And so that's something that should have been disclosed at the time, because he was a high-ranking federal official. Somebody else said that also during that time, when Justice Thomas was married in 1987 to his first wife, and he was chairman of the EEOC, that a third party paid for the wedding reception. And again, that wasn't disclosed either. So there's an increasing amount of reporting coming out over a long period of time about individuals making very large gifts to Justice Thomas, you know, individually, that should have been disclosed, and him not disclosing them. And so I think that's a bigger deal than the Christmas party Venmos. You know, I think the Christmas party Venmos may have just been reimbursements for out-of-pocket expenses that the clerk made, and not, you know, not really anything corrupt. But I think he should explain that.
Yeah, I mean, it would be an easy explanation. I think the problem for Thomas right now, and I think you've laid it out really well there, is that you have a long pattern of what appears to be some pretty terrible behavior. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. And again, this guy, you know, I came to, you know, when this first came out with ProPublica, I was a little skeptical. But I mean, the evidence is clear, and in a way where I didn't, you know, and again, we don't want to rehash everything, but in a way that I didn't see the evidence being clear for Alito, I see this being clear for Thomas. He clearly is, especially with the crow, you know, with his house, with his mom, with his, you know, I don't know what else. I mean, there doesn't even appear to be a plausible possibility for what that story is.
Well, he wants to like, you know, be sort of a kept man who's subsidized by his billionaire friends, and they get a lot of access to him because of that. And they ingratiate themselves with him, and they inculcate him with their worldview, and dispose him towards their
I don't think they've changed him any, but I think that him being who he is has allowed him to be in these positions, and they are happy that he is there and happy to lavish money on him because he is there. That doesn't make it any better. But I think what we should probably move on to now, Ken, is in the inflation data from this week. Inflation has finally showed some signs of abating. Now, this is one which I think that I was spot on about, right? I don't often say this about the show, but I'm going to say I was spot on about this, you know, forever. The message was, it's going to be a few months. It's going to be a few months. And I consistently argued that that was not going to be the case, that it was going to be well over a year. Here we are in 2023. Here we are in July, taking a look at June data. And the answer is, we're just now seeing inflation going now. That doesn't mean that damage hasn't been done, right? I mean, as NBC has shown, you know, the normal grocery bill is 40% higher than it was today than it was at the outset of the inflationary pressures. Now, inflation is cooling, but we're going to need to see time where that ends and what that looks like. Right now, food is still at a 4.7% increase. Overall inflation, however, and that's what has really been a positive sign, has dipped to 3%. Overall inflation hit its peak at 9%. And that has come slowly down from there. If you take a look at this past month in June, if you exclude fuel and food costs, inflation ticks just a little bit higher, ironically, at 4.8%. Now, Biden is hoping that this, especially if it continues, will, in his words, quote, show Bidenomics in action, end quote. Now, I have to say, and I'm curious what you think about this in a minute, Ken, I still think that's the dumbest name of all time, and whoever advised that should just be hit with a stick. Now, here's where I think the news gets a lot of this wrong. One of the big things this week was like, but look, people aren't rightfully indicating how much better they feel. And of course, the answer is obvious, and whether you know you're on the left or the right, it should be pretty straightforward. Economics is a lagged indicator, so nobody is going to be already polling differently as a result of June inflation numbers, right? That's not right. How this works. But I know that's the way, you know, the media oftentimes sets that up. And that's where many of these stories take this, right? You need to have a sustained lower inflation rate where you're going to see any kind of corresponding possibility for changes in people's feelings. Again, right? You don't come up 40% over the course of just barely 3 years, have 1 month where it's at 3% and then go, yay, I feel better. That's just not how that happens. And so that's why I think a lot of outlets this past week are still a little bit confused. You know, many of them are like, yeah, but, you know, Biden's approval rating is only 33% and only 24% say that what he's doing on the economy is doing a good job. And the answer is, well, whatever you think about whether he's a part of that or not, it's just too quick to see that happen. It's going to take a sustained moment. Ken, what do you think about this? I mean, obviously, inflation went on a long time. Again, I think a little more in line with what my predictions were. Where do you think things happen from here? And I'll even let you kind of flow into this because I know this is what everybody's always curious about. And it's clearly what you know the Biden team is hoping for is this might bode well for re-election bids.
Yeah, no, I think on the starting with the politics and then turning to the economics, one of the difficulties with these polls about, you know, how do people think, whatever, is those are incredibly influenced by partisan considerations, right? So I think, you know, Republicans and conservatives, you know, no matter what their financial situation is, they're very likely to say that the economy's not good and it's not improving because, you know, they just associate they can't dissociate that question from their thoughts about Biden. So I think you get kind of those kind of polls are, you know, not ultimately. I mean, they're important for political reasons, but not so much for economics, I think. You know, on the economic side
might be where you're taking a look at it in terms of Democrats, right? Democrats are polling pretty low on those fronts as well. That's why you get 24%. But continue.
Yeah. Well, that's a fair point. That is a fair point. So I think on the inflation itself, you know, I think you were, as you said, you were right on the timeline. You know, I didn't predict a timeline that I can remember, but I think I agreed with the direction that, you know, that there was a perfect storm of factors that made inflation go very, you know, spike really, because you had the combination of the supply chain problem, the energy price spike because of the sanctions against Russia, and the stimulus spending. And so you had like kind of a moment in time where there's more money than ever floating around, and there's less goods being produced and getting to market, and energy costs went up. And so, of course, there was this massive inflation spike. And just, you know, naturally, if nothing had been done, if no policies had been implemented, that was going to come down, because at a minimum, the supply chain problems that happened during the pandemic were, starting over time to be relieved, you know, the further we get from the disruptions of the pandemic, and things like that. But I also think that the Biden administration did everything extremely capably. You know, a lot of people were calling for them to panic a lot more than they did, and they kept a steady hand. And they kept raising interest rates. They kept announcing ahead of time, you know, and this was the Fed, too, not just the administration. But I think they were in communication with the administration. But they kept announcing ahead of time, inflation's still too high. We're still going to raise the interest rates by another 0.25% or 0.5%. We're going to keep doing that. We're going to keep doing that. They kept doing it. And eventually it had the effect of cooling off demand some. Without actually, causing any kind of recessionary impact. So employment stayed just as full as it's been, even as inflation came down. Inflation has been coming down, you know, for at least 6 or 9 months now. So, you know, it finally reached an end line, a finish line, where people would say, good, they got it pretty much all the way back down. But this is something that's been, you know, completely evident for the past 9 months, that every quarter inflation's been coming down compared to the previous quarter. And so it got all the way down. And, you know, I think if they would have tried interventions that were even more dramatic, it would have caused more hardship and more economic disruption and more unemployment, and would have hurt the stock market more. You know, the stock market came way up all year, too, at the same time that inflation was going down. So, you know, people who have investments have been making money at a much faster rate than inflation in 2023. And so I think the economy is looking really good right now.
Yeah, the things that I would add is, one, I wouldn't anticipate that you're going to see it. You're going to have a little bit of incremental moving. I actually agree with you in the front that I think we're basically at the end, but I think it'll spike a few times. And the reason I make that prediction isn't for anything kind of qualitative, but for a quantitative. You have an inverse of what you would expect in inflation rates right now. Normally, when you exclude food and fuel, you see inflation rate being lower than the overall inflation rate. But right now, that's actually flipped. Like I mentioned a second ago, we're seeing everything rise at that 3% rate in June, but you exclude fuel and food, and you have it at that 4.8%. I think that indicates that there's going to be some additional variability. And I don't say that as a panic, but just as a, you know, I'm not sure July, August, or September, you're going to see that same 3% until you see the more normal switch between those two numbers, which is the overall rate should be a little bit better. Excuse me, the overall rate should be a little bit worse than what you see it when you are including fuel and food. And that being, yeah. I mean, that would be one little quantitative thing. And I think people are missing out on that. And again, I don't say that in, you know, before I said, look, you know, we have inflation for a long time. I just think that means we have some variability coming up in the next 3 month cycles.
Well, food and fuel, of course, on the one hand, they're very important to people. People do spend a lot of money on food and fuel. But on the other hand, they're much more volatile than any policy could affect.
Oh, right? Yeah. Again, I wasn't suggesting that as a hit point towards anyone.
Yeah. So I think that's the problem. That's why all these measures like core inflation usually exclude them. But even there, you know, food, I think, is going to be a problem, you know, a kind of chronic problem, because climate change is affecting food production. And that's just something that, you know, people are going to, you know, be dealing with more and more. Fuel, I do think, you know, it'll come down. It'll go up and come down. The war in Ukraine is going to end at some point. And those markets are going to get a lot more supply. And also, this country is doing an incredible job towards moving towards renewables, and that is going to bring prices down as well. But in the short run, you know, of course, there's going to be a lot of volatility.
Now, the other thing to kind of get to that longer term, the political question that I know we both want to hit at as well. I don't often find myself saying this, but I think The Atlantic this past week had really an excellent point of view when it came to why lower levels of inflation is not immediately going to be a win for Biden. And that's not because necessarily anything is terrible inflation, but the corresponding numbers of people's purchasing power have lowered. And while jobs have remained high, which is a positive thing, what they can buy with those jobs, in other words, increase in wages has not kept up with inflation. I mean, I can tell you for sure I have lost a ton of money this way personally and for those around me. And we're going to see that continue. And the Atlantic's point, kind of a cautionary tale for how to run the campaign, was to say, you're going to have to be careful about this, because that's what, across the ideological spectrum, people have felt and will continue to feel, even with the lower inflation, since it's unlikely there's going to be a high wage increase between now, at least across the board, between now and the election. And I think that's a well-timed point by The Atlantic.
It's a really interesting thing. My sense is that low-wage jobs, the wages have gone up a lot, but not enough for people. But, you know, most of the minimum wages around the country are still in the single digits. They're below $10 an hour, as is the federal minimum wage. And I don't think there's too many jobs left that pay less than $12 an hour. And in many places, the de facto minimum is 15. So I think there have been some increases at the very low end, but 15 may not be enough for people to live on either. And I certainly do see the point that a lot of people who are in middle class jobs or upper middle class jobs have seen a lot of wage stagnation. You and I certainly both have in academia.
Yeah. I can say because again, this is something that I advocate for, you know, here at OC, in a real way, we've effectively had somewhere in the realm of a 23.5% pay cut, as a result of inflation.
Yeah, I mean, I think similar at NKU. We haven't had too many raises in the past decade, although they tend to still, you know, they don't hire as many people as they used to, but they at NKU, they tend to start entry-level people at current market wages. So a lot of people who are just starting as assistant professors will get paid more than people that have been working there for a long time, because the public sees what the entry-level salaries are. You know, the public doesn't see what the...
At least here in the private sector, I can't say that's been the case. Our entry-level wages have remained relatively steady here, But anyway, that is idiosyncratic, so we have to be careful about that.
We're griping about our own situations, but I think they are typical. Like, I think a lot of people who are, kind of experienced professionals who have been holding jobs for a while are not seeing raises that keep up with inflation. Whereas people at the lower end, you know, may not notice it, because, as I say, people who are earning $15 an hour may think that, you know, you can't live on that. But some of those jobs may have only been paying $10 an hour just a couple of years ago. A lot of jobs at that end, it's just impossible to fill them without raising wages. And actually, it's been hard for a lot of employers to fill jobs. You know, even at the $15 an hour level, there's an enormous amount of available jobs in the economy at that level right now. And I don't know what it's like in Oklahoma. Here in Cincinnati, when I walk around town, you know, very, very many retail and restaurant businesses have help wanted signs in the window and things like that. And, you know, it's just, I think, so maybe there'll be a little more upward pressure on wages. The other thing I would say is I would like to see more upward pressure from legislatures. Like, I think, if we're in kind of what the economists would call an oligopsony situation now, where, employers can't hire people because nobody wants the jobs at the wages that they're paying, but they also don't want to raise the wages. That's a good situation for legislatures to say, well, you have to raise the wages. And I think that could help. And I'd like to see more of it.
I think one of the reasons you don't see that in Congress is, of course, is, as you've noted, I think you do have a conversation going on between the White House and the Fed. And I know this seems, if you're listening, this seems weird, but it is, in fact, what the Fed looks for. You don't want to see wages rising when you're trying to deal with inflation, right? And so, anyway.
Yeah, but it's okay. I think that's the thing. You generally don't. That's absolutely right. But we're in a situation now where the management of the economy has been skillful, and inflation has already come down, and employment is still full, and there's still actually jobs going unfilled. So if we were still in a period of inflation, I would agree 100% with what you just said. But I think we've kind of hit the turning point where inflation's come low enough, and the bigger problem now is we need people to earn more, and we need we need maybe more jobs getting filled, and I think that could be prodded along without causing any significant inflation, because we've already hit that inflection point now.
Well, Ken, I know it's weird to say, but we've actually run out of time for the show. What that means is we're gonna have a packed show next week. So you need to come back for the third week in the Trey and Ken takeover of the politics guys.
Threepeat.
Exactly. I promise you that shortly Ken will let Jay out of his basement, and Mike will get back, and they'll start doing their thing. I made that joke about me having Jay in the basement, but as any good listener might know, is I don't have a basement. But be that as it may, we're going to have to call it that as being the end of the show for this week. And if you're not already a supporter of the Politics Guys, I really hope you'll consider becoming one, because it's supporters that make the show happen. But it doesn't just make the show happen. It gives you all kinds of benefits as well, like ad-free versions of this show. But really importantly, what Ken and I have been working on now for this year has been our midweek show project, where we go through the Constitution, and we'd love to have you join as we finish up Article 3 and get into Article 4 of the Constitution during this upcoming midweek show. So you get lots of benefits by being a supporter. So you don't just get the good feeling. You get that, of course, too, but you get these benefits as well. You can come along with myself and Ken. And not only do you get to come along for our newest episode where we tackle the end of Article 3 and get into Article 4, you can actually go back and listen to all of the shows in order. And I really encourage you to do that, because these are kind of not tied to the constraints of the news. They don't have a shelf life to them. I think they're useful all the time and kind of give you that broader context of politics and the Constitution. So if you are interested in making that happen, you want to get some of these benefits, then what you need to do is head to patreon.com/politicsguys. Again, that's patreon.com/politicsguys. And from there, you'll see all the different levels of support, what you're going to get for those levels of support, including, like I mentioned, the ad-free version of this show, the ad-free version of all of our shows, the exclusive supporters midweek show. We're going through the Constitution. But there's other things, too, like Discord. I have been actively on Discord recently. You can see people get after me. It's a lot of fun. You can see people agree, but we kind of have these real-time conversations in different channels. We'd love to have you there and have you taking part of those discussions. I've learned a few things myself, but it's a lot of fun. And if you head to patreon.com/politicsguys, you'll see all of those different levels of support, and you can see what level of support you'd like to be up to, and including all the way to being an executive producer of the Politics Guys. If you'd like to support us on Venmo, we're at Politics Guys. And again, just remember, those are public. You can also support the show through PayPal. All of those different support links are available in the show notes. Just scroll down on your phone or your tablet and you'll see them right there. Or if you'd like to head on a web browser, you can go to politicsguys.com/support. Again, that's politicsguys.com/support, or just scroll down and show more for all of those show notes. If you'd like to get our midweek show, but you're just not in a position to financially support the podcast right now, that's not a problem at all. Just send me send an email out to mike@politicsguys.com and we'll get you set up. As a matter of fact, I'll be sending out those links a little bit later today. And we'll get you set up. So whether you're a supporter or not, we would really appreciate it if you could subscribe, rate, review on the podcast app of your choice. Sharing those with others is huge for us, and I would really encourage you to do that. If you've got a comment, question, correction, gripe, or anything else you'd like to share, you can always reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you guessed it, you can find all of those in the show notes. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson Well, Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, Don Oglesby, and Ivan English. We'll be back with a new episode next week, and I hope you'll join us then.